The next case on this panel's argument calendar is White v. State, case number 68632. Mr. Coffey, how are you?
Doing good. Good afternoon, Justice.
Mr. Rogan, how are you doing today?
Can I reserve 3 minutes?
Yes, of course. You said three.
Three.
Yeah.
Good afternoon. I'm here on behalf of Troy White, the appellant in this case. There was one issue at trial, unlike most of the trials that the members of this court have sat on. There weren't contested facts. The sole issue at trial was Troy White's state of mind. And I think there were two errors fundamental in the trial court that prevented the jury from fairly and fully considering his state of mind at the time of the events. We've outlined the facts in the briefs, and if the justices have any questions about the facts, I'd be glad to reiterate those. But they're fairly straightforward. It's a relationship between a man and a wife. She starts a relationship with his best friend. The husband's none too happy about it, and eventually it ends up with her being shot inside the room. Our position at trial was that he had went back to a house that he owned to roust the individual who had been his former best friend, Joe Avery, from the house. The indication of that was simply that there was not an argument when he comes in. He didn't come in guns blazing. He actually asked for permission to see his wife. But at some point in the back room, an argument starts, and Mr. Avery approaches the back room, and as the door opens, White fires shots. He hits his wife, kills his wife, hits Mr. Avery twice, tells Mr. Avery, I should kill you, but doesn't go through with that. During the trial, the court put on, state put on, 100-plus text messages over the course of weeks and a number of Facebook posts to say that he had been harboring this festering hatred and was planning to go there with a plan, willful, deliberate, premeditated plan on killing his wife. The jury rejected, ultimately, that version of events and convicted him on second-degree murder, but they did convict him on murder. We asked to put in a couple of voice messages that were left 9:40 a.m. The killing happens around noon. At 9:40 a.m., the morning of the shooting, they were right in the course of the text messages that had been sent back and forth. And our position was that they were necessary for the jury to be able to understand Mr. White's state of mind. They were in direct rebuttal to an argument that the state made and eventually would actually capitalize on in closing, that during the closing portion, they said it was clear by 9 a.m. that Mr. White had went there with the intention to kill. But at 9:40, he leaves a voice message that's crying. We've actually thought it was important enough that we've placed it in the record for the court to be able to listen to. He says essentially, please take me back, quit seeing him, start seeing me, you know, let's get on with our lives. And he's been pulled back and forth for a week. He'd moved out of the house voluntarily, but at some point it's clear there's talk of reconciliation, and that goes back and forth and breaks down. The position in the respondent's brief was that these text messages were somehow enough for the defense to present, that we didn't need to present these voice messages, they are cumulative. I don't believe that's accurate. First off, they are different in kind than the text messages. There's a difference between a voice message that is left on the machine, being able to hear the impact and the emotional breakdown of this man, and a stale text message. Secondly, they are in direct rebuttal, and I think this goes to the Tavish case that was decided by this court some time ago concerning state of mind. State of mind was the only issue. The state had put the state of mind at issue. These were in direct rebuttal to whether or not he was going there planning to kill or whether he was going there with the intention of doing something else, reconciliation, a last-ditch effort. One of his friends, Herman Allen, had said afterwards, and Mr. White turned himself in eventually, but Herman Allen had said, you know, I was concerned that Troy was going to kill himself. And for all I know, that's what he went to the house to do, maybe to give her an ultimatum, maybe to kill himself in front of her in a grand gesture. It's really impossible to tell, but I think the voice messages were critical to our ability to present a case that he was just an emotional mess by the time that he got to the house, that he wasn't really thinking clearly and doing much of anything. And when Mr. Averman appeared in the doorway, everything came rushing back and he snapped and acted in the sudden heat of passion, which brings us to our second issue, I suppose, which is the instruction that we tendered on heat of passion. Nevada's got a statute that defines heat of passion, and the statute talks about the heat of passion being sudden, but it doesn't talk about the nature of the provocation. It's whether or not the provocation has to be sudden. And a common sense, human nature will tell you that provocation can take place over a series of events and over a series of time. One of the cases that we cited in our moving papers was People versus Wharton out of California. People versus Wharton comes to this conclusion, and I know respondent's brief says Wharton is a little different because the California statute, Model Penal Code 192, is written somewhat differently. Actually, it's narrower than what we've got in our state. It just says it has to be on a sudden quarrel or during the heat of passion. Our statute doesn't specifically delineate how passion has to occur, and it seems to me that what makes sense is the passion has to be reasonable, that the provocation has to be reasonable, and that's the jury's ultimate decision. We ask for instruction directing the jury to that point, that passion can form over provocation of a series of events. One of the cases cited in the state's papers from California, Berry, has facts remarkably similar to what we've got in this particular case. In Berry, it was a situation where a man had married a woman, and over the next 13 days, she started to say, I love another man, and pull him back and send him forth, and pull him back and send him forth. And they said that really should be a jury consideration. And that was our position here, was that it should have been a jury consideration. But the way the Nevada statute is drafted without additional help, it's hard for a jury to come to a conclusion concerning how provocation might work. Everything's written in the present tense. So there's no real clear indication as to whether or not provocation can take place over a period of time or not. The instruction that we tendered was exactly on that point, that the provocation may take place over a period of time or over a series of events. The statute in question here is NRS 200-060, and the language in question is the provocation given in the killing sufficient. Okay, let me back up. Okay, for if there should appear to have been an interval between the assault and provocation given and the killing sufficient for the voice of reason and humanity to be heard, the killing shall be attributed to deliberate revenge and punished as murder. It doesn't define what that period should be. There's nothing in there that says the provocation must be instantaneous. We don't have the sudden language that we do when we talk about the impulse that must be sudden. It says whether the time is sufficient. And I would pose to this court that in certain situations, a bar fight, the provocation ends very quickly, and if someone comes back and takes revenge, that may make sense. But in other situations, the provocation and the voice of reason are much more difficult for the common person to hear. And this is one of those situations where you have a man desperately in love with his wife, desperately wanting his family back, and trying to get there, for lack of a better description. So I think the instructions that we tendered were appropriate, and I think the court was wrong in refusing the instruction concerning timing. There was some indication in the state's brief that they believed that we had the voicemails were cumulative in some sense, and I don't believe it fits cumulative for a variety of reasons, going back to this Gray versus Harrison from 1865 here in Nevada all the way through the Miller case in the Ninth Circuit as late as 2013. Gray versus Harris says essentially that if it goes to the primary issue, and here the only issue was state of mind, if it goes to the primary issue, the cumulative rule doesn't apply, and that's what these voice messages did, I believe, is they went to the primary issue of the case, his state of mind at the time of the killing. So I don't know how it's cumulative. The Miller case talks about bolstering, and it says that evidence that bolsters a defense, and this certainly bolsters his claim of heat of passion, is also not cumulative. When you look at the state of mind exception in particular, the statute lists a number of things that are admissible: intent, plan, motive, design, feelings, pain. Those are the sorts of things that we were trying to put in front of the jury. We had text messages, but the only tangible evidence that we had that was our own that we offered, it was probably the most telling piece of evidence as to his state of mind going into this situation, were these voice messages. I believe, again, that they were wrongfully excluded based on the rules of hearsay. They weren't offered for the truth of the matter asserted. They were offered under the state of mind exception. And finally, I think the completeness. And, you know, the doctrine of completeness, I think, is very interesting in today's day and age. I think it's something, if this court hasn't struggled with, should struggle with. How does the rule of completeness work in the day of modern technology with text messages that are limited to 264 characters or whatever it might be? Because we have text messages back and forth, we have voice messages. It's part of an entire conversation. During closing argument, the state even called these text messages part of an entire conversation. But then we come in and parse it out and say, we only want the good stuff from the state side. We want the 90 or so that we think we can argue that he had this plan in his mind, in his heart when he went. But we don't want to offer the complete story. I think that lack of a complete story is the reason the errors here are fundamental and the reason that his right to fair trial was denied pursuant to the Sixth Amendment. So unless the court has a question for me, I will turn it over to my learned colleague.
Apparently not. Mr. Rogan.
Good afternoon. I'm Jeff Rogan on behalf of the respondent, the state of Nevada. The issue that the appellant brings up is one of importance determining whether this appellant received a fair trial. And of course, this was a fairly clean trial, as appellant pointed out. There were only two issues that he raised on appeal. The first being whether it was an abuse of discretion for Judge Gonzalez to exclude the voicemail messages that the appellant so wanted to admit, going so far as today to say that they were crucial to their case. And the objection that we raised at trial was not only that they were cumulative, but they were also hearsay, because they certainly were the statement of the appellant himself that he was trying to admit, and they were not against his interest, so certainly that was had to be taken into consideration first, whether they could, in fact, proffer their own statement without being subject to cross.
But couldn't it just, state of mind was an issue, and if state of mind is what they were being admitted for, that's not hearsay.
Well, I'd urge you to actually listen to or review what the voicemail messages actually say. Because if you look at what they say, the first one being a 5:30 in the morning, 2:36 voicemail message that he left, he's actually not discussing his state of mind. He's actually recounting a conversation that he had had with the victim, Echo Lucas, several days before, reminding her what she had told him. So not only did Judge Gonzalez look at the fact that it's the statement of the defendant, but it's also the statement of the victim, hearsay within hearsay. And for example, in these voicemail messages, he says, you wanted your time, your space. No, it's unacceptable. You had your time and space. If you want me, then you should have called me up and said you want to be back. How is that state of mind? Later on, in that same text messages, about a minute and a half in, he starts talking about his opinion of how the children have been are being raised. He says, you still want him. You still want the relationship. You still want to be away from me. That's not about his state of mind. That's his opinion of her state of mind. Continuing on saying, fighting on the verge of divorce, separated, our kids miserable, like demons, because they are undisciplined, because they have no dad over there. That is the text, the voicemail messages that counsel is talking about. Nowhere in this until the very end does he actually say anything about his state of mind, and that is, I love you, and I will be waiting for you, but I don't know how long. That arguably is the only, in that 2:36 voicemail message where he actually says what his state of mind is. And interestingly, if you look at the text messages that were emitted, he says almost exactly the same thing about about 3 hours later to Echo Lucas in the text message saying, I will be waiting for you, if I could find it, I will be waiting for you, but only for this weekend. Come home, my sweetie, come home. My heart is yours. You will stop all, if you will stop all you're doing, meaning having a relationship with another man. That was at 8:58 that morning. And that goes to the cumulative nature of that voicemail message. You have the expression that the appellant wanted to admit, that he wanted his love of his life back. But you also have that in the text messages. But with the voicemail message containing so much hearsay, so much inadmissible evidence that doesn't go to the appellant's state of mind, it was the proper decision by Judge Gonzalez to keep those voicemail messages out. Now, if appellant had simply redacted everything that had nothing to do with his state of mind, then I would be wrong here. But they didn't. They were trying to admit the entirety of that voicemail message that certainly did not go to the state of mind. So that is the context, the full context, in which those voicemail messages were offered to be proven and proven to be.
Mr. Rogan, let's say the court finds an independent basis. So either it wasn't hearsay or it's offered for a non-hearsay purpose. Just for purposes of argument, let's say that the court were to find that. Do you think it was cumulative then in such that was it undue consumption of time or just because it reiterated that the defendant should have been precluded from producing that oral statement?
I think that if the court were to find that the statements themselves were independently admissible, the entirety of the statements, then certainly I don't think that the entirety of those statements would be cumulative. He brings up details of the conversation that he had with Echo Lucas the prior Wednesday that were not admitted. Again, that's why I don't think that you could reach this hypothetical. Discussing his opinion of what she said, and of course we don't know exactly what she said because she's dead. So in that way, that entire voicemail message wouldn't be cumulative. But the state of mind issue, I love you, I want you back, I'll be waiting, but not for long, certainly is cumulative. It was already presented.
Presented by the state. So the state then would be the one who to decide how it presented that sentiment solely. So if you present it and it says he wants to get back together in type and the defense wants to put it in verbal, then you essentially the state decides because it's going to be cumulative. Does that make sense? I mean, I appreciate the court decides.
And that's the argument that was made, and that was made by the appellant at the time. But again, looking at the entirety of the statements with the inadmissibility of the remainder of the statement, that's certainly problematic. And again, that's why we redact certain statements if we anticipate there to be issues, and that simply wasn't done by the appellant. And I think there's a reason for that. Because if we move on to the second argument, which is talking about a provocation, a series of provocations, an expansion of the idea of our voluntary manslaughter, what are the provocations, the series of provocations that the appellant alleges in his brief? Number one, that Echo left him. Number two, that she began a relationship with another man, and number three, that she wouldn't take him back. Those are the provocations that the appellant says incited him over time to suddenly engaging or becoming consumed by this irresistible passion that he could not think about shooting and killing his wife and shooting and killing Joe or attempting to kill Joe Averman. And if you look at the context of the appellant trying to make that argument to a jury, it becomes important what the appellant thought of Echo Lucas's statement. And what evidence was there of that? It was that voicemail message, that hearsay statement where he relates his interpretation of that conversation. That would be key to the appellant to argue that look at the series of provocation. The Wednesday before I killed my wife, I had a conversation with her where she says, I want you back. I want the little things that we used to love to do together back. And then several days later, she says, no, I changed my mind. I don't want you back. That is what the appellant wanted in front of that jury. Not, I love you, I'll be waiting for you, but look at how she provoked me. And he wanted that in front of the jury, I think, without having to testify about that and be subject to cross-examination, which, of course, I think that was taken into consideration by the court. With regard to, furthermore, with the voluntary manslaughter I'm particularly concerned about the idea that there can be a series of provocations over time. Nevada does have a differing statutory framework for voluntary manslaughter than California. And in looking at California, they seem to have backed away from voluntary manslaughter in the eyes of an objective standard and have taken a subjective standard. In Nevada, of course, the provocative action must excite the irresistible passion of an ordinary, reasonable person. So that's an everyday person off the street, not the everyday person with the experiences of the appellant in his relationship, but you or me, anyone else. Would we come into that situation inside that bedroom where that killing took place? And our response to that is based upon our ordinary reactions, not our feelings of abuse, feelings of slighted by our wife leaving for another man, or even our psychological difficulties with getting over a relationship. It's the ordinary, reasonable person. In Wharton, California seems to have backed away from that, because in Wharton, even though they didn't find error with the voluntary manslaughter instructions that were presented in that case, they did say the jury should have been allowed to hear about the psychological, the statement to the psychologist that the defendant in that case was having difficulty controlling his anger over time. The fact that they had been drinking, Wharton and his wife, for several weeks, the fact that they were essentially pathetic persons living in squalor, and I'm using language directly from that statute, directly from that case. But we don't have that in Nevada. Ours is completely objective, and I think that's the way it should remain. We shouldn't be looking at the specific details of a particular relationship. It's for several reasons. First, it's completely unfair. There's one person that's left standing in this situation most of the time, a defendant. A defendant can come up and say anything that he wants about the relationship, a relationship that occurs in private, the private conversations, the little slights that can be truthful or untruthful. And we have no way of rebutting it, because the person that would rebut that is the decedent, is the victim. It also expands, I think, the fundamental idea that the legislature had with the idea of voluntary manslaughter. And that is simply that there's a minority of cases where we're going to say, right, legislative fiat, that there's no malice here, that this is something that would excite the irresistible passions in one of us. The obvious case being walking in on your spouse having an affair with another person, or another case that I've read about is discovering that someone that you love and trust has been abusing your child. Now, that's certainly situations where someone of an ordinary disposition might be excited to an irresistible passion. But if we expand this in the way that the appellant wants, and look at it in circumstances of the way the appellant presents it, that is, that it is provocation to leave your spouse, that it's provocation to begin a new relationship with a different man, that it's provocation to not want to go back to your spouse, what message does that send to the community? Don't leave your spouse. Don't start a new relationship within a certain period of time. And finally, go back to your spouse if in fact you do. Because if we're saying that is provocation, then that message is what we're saying is unacceptable behavior. And I don't think leaving your spouse, no matter what the circumstances, should be considered a provocation. And I don't think that a woman should have to decide whether it's provocation when she begins a new relationship with a man. And I don't think that a woman should have to make a decision whether to go back to a man, to go back to a former spouse or former lover would be considered a provocation. And that's the trouble that I have with the appellant's position, because those are the exact reasons that he proffers he would have said to the jury as sufficient provocation justifying reduction from murder to manslaughter. And for those public policy reasons, I just can't imagine that being the case. I do see I have 2.5 minutes left, so if the court has any further questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Apparently not.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Carvey.
With the key public policy here is to allow the jury to decide a case based on the facts. And without hearing those voice messages, they decided the case on an incomplete
set of facts. That's evident, I think. The court says, or the respondent says, what would an ordinary person do? I don't know. I'm not sure, and that's what the jury should have been deciding here. That's the point. They should have been able to consider everything. There's a talk about expanding the notion of heat of passion, that that is what Mr. White would like to do, to set up his own standard. The jury's given instruction that people are not entitled to set up their own standard of conduct. They are judged by an ordinary, reasonable person standard. I think that's covered in the instructions. But outside of that, there are two cases in Nevada. One is Boykins, the other is Roberts, that I think embrace the idea of passion taking place over a period of time. Boykins recognized the ability to put on battered women syndrome by necessity. That is provocation that takes place over a period of time. I understand it's a self-defense case. But again, self-defense has some similar elements that leads to me an immediate threat of harm. And you can consider past instances as to whether or not there's an immediate threat of harm or the perception of an immediate threat of harm. And that's really the key here, is Mr. White's perception of things.
Was there any evidence in the record in this case that there was any ongoing domestic violence? Anything that would indicate that?
Not that I remember.
Consistent with 48061?
Not against Mr. White, anyway. I think there may have been an allegation at some point, and I don't remember whether it was admitted at the trial because I didn't think it was that significant one way or the other, as whether or not there had been an allegation of Mr. White having a physical domestic situation with Echo in the past. I just don't remember off the top of my head. The other case is Roberts. And Roberts is very close. When Roberts has decided, Roberts is a blue-collar person, and he has dinner playing with his wife, and he sees her truck parked in front of a trailer and realizes she's having a sexual relationship with somebody else, and he stood her up, and the court said that he was entitled to voluntary manslaughter instructions in that case, and he was entitled to them because he could view being stood up as a callous insult. Now, being stood up steps backwards in time. He's got a triggering event that's forwards in time at the time that the event here happens. But the provocation in that instance, I think at least implicitly, takes place over a series of events. Because we're not automatons. We are not robots. We are not computers. That's not the way the human psyche works or the human heart works. Provocation takes place over time. Would a jury have agreed with Mr. White? I don't know. I don't know without presenting this additional evidence. That's the reason that we thought it should have been presented. The state of mind, the state said very briefly that his opinion of her state of mind doesn't evidence his state of mind. I beg to differ with that. I think his opinion of what he thought she was going to do evidences his state of mind directly. Even if it was wrong, even if what he thought she was saying was wrong, I think it affects his state of mind. It might go to reasonableness, I suppose, whether his interpretation is reasonable. But what he thinks she is doing to him defines his state of mind. That's the reason I should have been allowed to admit the messages. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Coffey, Mr. Rogan, thank you very much for your excellent arguments today and your briefing in the case. Very interesting questions. The case will stand submitted. Thank you both.
Thank you.